Yozium Suichmir, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Azerbaijani for my eye does not drink water.
Okay.
Or roughly equivalent to being suspicious, to feeling that something fishy is going on. Amazingly, I don't have a news story or anything to relate to this, but, you know, it's something that happens a lot in Formula One. Fishy stuff going on.
And they are driving beside the water.
I just really like the phrase. So when there's a good phrase, I got to say it. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, Danny O'Dwyer. How are you, Danny?
Very good. I cannot wait for your book of international idioms to finally come out. It feels like you've been working on it for a number of years now. And I, for one, cannot wait to recap just all of the terrific expressions I've learned over the years, which will help me in all of these countries when I go to them to speak like some sort of alien man who's only able to tell stories like in that one Star Trek episode.
That's right. Yes. Someone does every year clip out the phrases and make a yes. supercut of them. On Twitter, so shout outs to them. Also joining us, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Oh, not too bad. Just came off another good motorsports weekend with the farewell IndyCar race at Belle Isle.
Was it the last one there?
Yeah, they're going to a Detroit street circuit next year.
Oh, okay.
And by the way, Danny's image, for me at least, is now confetti. Beautiful AV confetti
on
Discord.
Cool.
Lovely.
But yeah, so Belle Isle, where they've raced for ages, for as long as I can remember. This was the last year, which is a bit of a bummer. It looked like one reason they want to get away from it is it is old and the concrete is buckled, but it's hilariously buckled and therefore maybe is good, because you know it's rare you have an off camber straight, but it's interesting to run a car over an off camber straight at speed.
I bet. We're going to have a lot of bumps on this street circuit as well. Baku, it's a normal-ass road. I know they resurfaced them every year now.
Hey, you never
much.
Know when a manhole cover is going
to
launch itself.
This might be,
especially
is this
the
maybe the
era.
Most? Yeah, this you're right. This might, I feel like you're right. Yeah, maybe Baku is maybe the most treacherous for manholes, etc. There's been a lot of that. And crashing under safety car.
If you're new to this podcast and don't understand all of these references, a very warm welcome to you. And we have a preseason primer episode just for you that assumes no prior F1 knowledge, explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it's episode 178. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. So what's going on this month, Danny?
The media pass holders can now celebrate the end of COVID. celebrate the end of not seeing us in the same meat space by checking out a terrific.
Hey, can we just like
sorry.
Make sure not seeing us? Just hit the separation on that a little better.
I'm so sorry. Not seeing myself and Drew in the same place together, Rob. We missed you.
Well, no, I mostly what I heard was we were out not seeing like the German fascist party.
Oh,
and
sorry.
I was like,
like the Germans Workers' Party. Is that,
yeah.
Like, is that, yeah. Yeah. They have a very charismatic leader. I've been hearing a lot about him. Not sorry. We were not making Nazi propaganda. We were drinking wine, beautiful Australian wine from Daniel Ricciardo. Daniel Ricciardo's terrific wine was sent to us by Circuit Demon donkeys years ago. Was it before COVID? It might have been before. I think it might have been, yeah.
Early in, at least.
Because it was, I think it was around Melbourne 2020. So that would have been back when Melbourne was the opening race, right? When it got cancelled. I think it was around then. So I've been sitting on this beautiful bottle of wine for 2 years. Drew came to my backyard. We sat down. We had a picnic with some cheese and crackers and my cat, and a squirrel turned up. And we recorded a 20-minute video of us opening this bottle of wine and chatting about Formula One, and it's up now for media pass holders.
And trying to be wine guys.
Yes.
Which really
what was the description that Daniel Ricciardo had on the bottle of wine?
I don't remember.
It was something ridiculous, like it was flavorsome. It was like so vague. It was something so like you could apply to basically anything you put in your mouth. Flavorsome. Yeah. It's very flavorsome wine.
That was fun. It was good. We're just kind of reflecting on, you know, podcast, the season, F1 in general, and having some wine with my buddy.
Yeah, it was a good time. So if you're a media pass holder, go check out the Patreon feed and you can go check that out right now. It's in 4K as well. We spare no expense. I know, right? We're also working on our Patreon exclusive podcast this month. It's going to be Love the Beast, the Eric Bana documentary series where you learn that he only acts so that he can race cars. And of course, none of this would be possible, but all of our patrons, including our terrific title sponsors, such as Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, At Talking Autos, Tanner McCleave, Wealth Energy, Olivia Evans, Pyrite's Card Castle, Erica Siegel, Iron Station Studios, Alan McCrary, TelemetryDuck.com, Gnarly Goat, David Mule, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foote, Abdullah Althani, Jason Chadwick, Abraham Getchell, Octothorpe Bunny Crimes, YourTop6.games, Sniggs, Alex Goucher, Max Valtar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, Umberto Rocco, William Romph, and Jason Kelly.
Right on. Well, let us jump directly into the news, everyone. A whole lot going on in terms of salacious bits out there, but we do have, I would say, one of those kind of softly very important news stories. The cost cap is one that's kind of been, has had a pretty long trajectory over the past few years. This is the rule that F1 teams are only allowed to spend a certain amount. There are various mechanisms in place on what they can and can't spend it on. I think a big question mark for us, at least, is like, well, how does this actually get policed? And what do fines look like? How does this all work if someone breaches it? Well, we've had the first breach, and it's Williams of all teams.
Right.
Though I suppose, you know, being bought by an American investment firm and being in the back of the field means that, well, a lot of money is getting spent.
They are called Dorrington Capital. We've lots of capital to spend.
Yeah, sounds very
Nicholas Latifi costs a fortune.
costs a lot to look this good. although it's not, it's more of a technical breach. The FIA, this from Autosport, said that Williams had failed to submit its complete full year reporting documentation by the deadline, which is March 31st, 2022. And was fined $25,000. So not a big deal. But I think it would be if it was me. Well, right.
If the IRS did that, I'd probably get my taxes done a few weeks earlier.
Or if it was Williams a couple years ago.
Yeah.
but I think this, the bigger story here is that, you know, in the age of this coincided with the pandemic, you know, the cost cap coming into effect. And a lot of team principals, most loudly, not a surprise, Christian Horner, is like, well, hey, everything is more expensive now, so you should raise the cost cap. Of course, Red Bull has money to spare, so of course he would be saying this. But not everyone agrees. Of course, Alpine specifically has said that they already factored the possibility of cost increases, you know, from inflation and shipping and everything into their budget from the start, so that would be unfair. Ferrari's Mattia Binotto, again, this from the Autosport article, warned that there was a way his team would be able to fall under the cap, but it was unclear what the consequence would be, as there is no fixed penalty for what is known as a minor breach of the rules, which is within 5% of the limit. And Horner also in this article says, what's the penalty for a minor breach? So it's just a lot of question marks and confusions. So he says, what I think we do need is clarity, and clarity quickly, because they're coming up against it. Horner even said, and again, it's tough to tell with him whether this is real or if it's just an extreme exaggeration, but he's saying like there are teams that could miss Grand Prix, you know, because they don't have the shipping cost to fly to, you know, Brazil or whatever.
Right. Because they spent their budget already on other things that maybe they shouldn't. Yeah, I totally understand the politics that are at play here, because the cost cap ultimately is sort of a, you know, it's not arbitrary in terms that it's not important, but it is a rule that has been sort of arbitrarily imposed on the sport by everyone to try and, you know, by the FIA, by F1, to try and, you know, curb the runaway spending of the big teams, but also by the big teams to try and find where they're comfortable with. So it makes sense that there's always going to be some pushing and pressure on that number, be it for this year or the next year or whatever. It's just kind of like part and parcel of this. The idea that like they suddenly now hadn't factored for inflation, or like the idea that like you don't budget a business with these things in mind is kind of silly. But I can also see that like if things are getting tight, they're looking downstream and expecting maybe that they're not going to be the only team that runs into this issue, and maybe trying to figure out what the penalty is to see whether or not the penalty is worthwhile. You know, it's kind of like a lot of business will factor in that sort of stuff. Like it's
sure.
The sort of financial carbon offsetting of the corporate world is to just take it on the chin on the other end. Especially if it ends up just being a fine, like Red Bull can pay a fine. So I do think if there's no clarity for it, it makes complete sense, because if they are coming up against this thinking, hey, look, we may need to, you know, rein in our spending right now, are we going to get hit with a points penalty? They probably want that clarified ASAP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly what he's saying here. Mm. But related to that, salary caps, Rob.
Yeah, so there has been some discussion from some of the teams about the idea of introducing a driver salary cap, which right now there is not. Nor is there a salary cap for, I think, three like technical staff for each team. So that, for instance, like if you like Adrian Newey can get paid what Adrian Newey is worth on the market, right? If you're an Adrian right. Newey level talent, like what you do for a team would be a huge percentage of $140 million. Is it pounds that they calculate this in?
Or it's dollars, I think.
Yeah. So that'd be a huge part of it. So they exempt like senior technical staff from this. They exempt drivers from it. And some teams have sort of indicated that this is a little unfair and could be a place where teams would like to see costs a bit more controlled and have a little bit more parity in the driver's market. This is like an idea that is just loosely being kicked around. In the Autosport article, one thing that's alluded to is that a couple teams, including Alfa Romeo and Alpine, have proposed instituting a $30 million per year cap on what you can pay that is not counted as that $140 million. And then if you want to go over $30 million, now you are dipping into your team budget, right? So if you want to pay if you want to pay your star like $40 million a year, $30 million of that is cool. $10 million of that is going to come out of your $140 million for team operations. For one thing, Mattia Binotto is very clear that this is very preliminary. It's a complicated issue. He doesn't feel like they're really ready to figure out what the solution is there, especially since you have driver contracts already inked, and that's always going to be an issue. Like there's always going to be like extant contracts that like will not play nicely with whatever the new regime is. So that's a thing that has to be figured out. But it's also going to move the drivers into tension with this. Alonso sort of raised the question of why are we talking about capping driver pay when we're driving more races than ever before? We have a harder schedule than ever before. You know, in what world does that make sense? And I think he's right. Like, I think everywhere that salary caps have been instituted, generally it has been a good thing for, like, franchise owners and a bad thing for talent. I think, but I will say, I don't think there's anything special about the drivers here, as opposed to like just technical staff and mechanics, right? That, like, you know, if we're saying that the entire team, the headcount that goes to the races and such, all their salaries count against the $140 million, then you have created a situation where if inflation is just going to increase freight costs, the pressure is going to be on wages. And these are people who have already, like, they talk about, like, you know, bad accommodations at the events.
23 of them now.
Yeah. And
during a pandemic.
Yeah. And so the thing is, like, I think Alonso's making a good point, but, like, it's as true of the drivers as it is for, like, mechanical staff. And so I do think that the cost cap thing is barreling toward a conflict with the various forms of labor that exist in F1. You know, my concern, but my suspicion would also be that, like, drivers and the people in that elite tier of engineering staff are not going to see a lot of, like, interest shared between them and, like, the mechanics and the crews, but I do think it's there. Like, I think that the cost cap, especially in an environment that's getting tougher in terms of inflation and just like transit and logistical infrastructure around the world, that's something the teams are going to have to absorb, and the only place that they're going to see an easy way to make cuts without compromising their competitive edge is going to be with wages. So I do think, like, the cost cap thing has been generally, like, it's a good notion for, like, making the sport a little, like, creating a little more parity between the teams. But what it's going to do for, like, the F1 labor market, I think, is not great, and we could see some real tension open up about how this is all accounted for and who is basically helping the teams comply with this.
It's putting pressure it's accumulating pressure on a lot of other factors, you're right, that, like, aren't, that are probably in many ways more important, especially because I've always wanted to know this. I've always wanted to sit down with somebody on the financial side of an F1 team and try and get an understanding of how much flex you have with regards to driver compensation, because there's so much advertising money coming in. Like, is it easier to put on the books that your driver is getting X amount minus a certain amount and then offset that with your sponsors? You know what I mean? Because, like, the sponsors are sponsoring the team, but they're sponsoring the driver. So if you get them to pay the driver for a cut of the sponsorship, can you offset that up again? You know what I mean? Like,
well, this is always,
we're going to pay you $1 million, but Mission Winnow is going to pay you $29 million.
Totally. Exactly. Like, because that's basically the way it, you know, it works. I'm sure I don't think that if a driver is driving for a team that they do their own sponsorship stuff. I have a feeling that all of the sponsorship is tied to it with the team. I don't know if that's the case. Maybe you can go do Fruity Pebbles commercials if you're Nicholas Latifi on the side.
But there's weird situations, yeah, like where, like, at least for a long time, Alonso brought that Santander sponsorship with him.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so...
Right, was that associated with him, or was it that they just liked him and kept going?
Yeah, so did he have, like, a spokesman deal for Santander alongside they also sponsor his teams, right? So, like, this is, like, basically the Nike model, where it's Nike isn't paying LeBron James's salary for the Lakers. The Lakers are paying LeBron James, but LeBron James is also getting a huge amount of money for, like, the Nike contract. Does that exist across, like, and I think that's been part of the F1 model for a while, which is that, like,
right,
if you're a big enough driver, of course, like, These sorts of promotional deals come your way. But I do know that when the cost cap was instituted, there was a lot of hand-wringing about this type of, like, weird phantom accounting you could do, where, like,
right,
sponsorship promotion budgets could be a way to mask, like, various forms of pay and compensation. So I think it's a mess, because accounting is always, like, complicated, especially when there's an incentive to, like, create special buckets that don't count.
Yeah, so, to 100%. Yeah. And it seems very easy to do that with the drivers.
Yeah.
Just by, so I'd love to know. I suspect not much of this is there's not much light shone upon this for the exact reasons of it just being a small pool of people, very specific, and obviously incredible amounts of money. But yeah, they must have accounted for this in some aspect of the financial fair play stuff for F1, but yeah, it does seem relatively opaque still.
Well, speaking of very special people, Rob, what's this next story?
Well, just Helmut Marko noting that in the Sergio Perez signing, that basically put paid to any notion that Pierre Gasly was going to return to the team anytime soon, which,
right,
you know, by a lot of measures, he certainly earned with, you know, pretty strong performances throughout his time at AlphaTauri. And so he was asked about that by a French outlet, I think, and he was very matter-of-fact, a very Marco-ish comment. He said, before the signing, I, of course, spoke to Gasly, explained the situation. And yes, we'll have to see what happens with Gasly after 2023. But what would be the alternative? I don't think there's any alternative for him at the moment that would be significantly better than AlphaTauri. Which I think is true.
Mm.
I mean, well,
to stay in the Red Bull ecosystem. Open up. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, I in a weird way, I think Gasly's performance at AlphaTauri, to me, this is awful because, like, what else do you do? But there are some drivers who really relish this type of team that overperform in an underperforming car, and that when it comes to the sort of like more, I don't know, last 5% of a car situation of the bigger teams don't do it. And obviously he is one of a number of drivers who struggled at Red Bull. Also, they were all very young when they went in there, and not everyone is Max Verstappen. Not everyone has been abandoned by their parents at racetracks and is full of professional fury about it. So, yeah, in a way, I feel like he kind of is making a good case for him being just like a super solid mid-team driver. So I do wonder if he's not as exciting for people, maybe. Yeah, and Checo is like the best number two they've had, for sure. This year will remain to be seen how it shakes out, because we could end up in a very Weber Vettel situation if the the title is tight and you have a veteran finally in a good car and a young upstart who doesn't want to get out of the way, which would be awesome. But I feel bad for him, but also I don't feel that bad for him. He's driving well, he's getting paid, and it's he's lucky the AlphaTauri is a decent car, actually.
Yeah, and if a spot opens up elsewhere, that's the best, like one of the best resumes on the grid, I'd say.
Although leaving a Red Bull team has not worked out so well for some people.
It's true. It's true, Danny. Fantastic.
You're welcome.
Transition there. let's talk a little bit about Ricardo. Mm. It just continues to not look any better over there. And Formula1.com has collected some quotes here from the parties involved. McLaren CEO Zach Brown has a quote here. Daniel is just not comfortable yet with the car. We're trying everything we can. Short of Ricardo's victory at Monza and a few races, it's generally not met his or our expectations as far as what we're expecting. I think that's what expectations means. And I think all you can do is keep working hard as a team, keep communications going, keep pushing, and hope that whatever is not kind of clicking at the moment clicks here shortly. So Ricardo was asked about these comments ahead of the Monaco Grand Prix. And Ricardo replied, it's not false. It's pretty true. Firstly, the comments I don't take personally. My skin is tanned, beautiful, and also thick. but it hasn't met our expectations. It's been a little bit tricky for me to always gel 100% with the car and feel like I can pull out these, I'm trying to say like spectacular laps, but that sounds like I'm really bigging myself up. But yeah, just to pull out these heaters, I guess. It has been more tricky for sure. There's been some races and times when it's been good, but honestly, still working at it. I mean, it's hard not to feel for Ricardo here. It sounds like what both drivers are saying about the Haas car, where it's like it's the completely different, or just from one race to the next, and we can't get a handle on it. However, the one big difference there is one driver is getting a handle on it.
Yeah.
And after, what, a year and a half in that car, Ricciardo still is not really anywhere close to his teammate Lando Norris in performance there. We talked a little bit last week about, you know, the fact that Ricciardo still has one more year on his contract. He's signed through to 2023, but I think an important thing to bring up is that there are a lot of times, you know, escape clauses for the teams in situations like this. Like, if you are a driver, yes, you're signed, but that part of the stipulation is if you are not meeting, you know, a certain threshold, like, I don't know, average, if you're not in the top 10 of the championship, you know, by this point in the season, we can release you. No indication of that, but I don't think that's so far out of the question.
No, and there was a lot of this sort of like broke post Monaco, where there was, I forget who said it, the quote, but there was basically a question raised of like, I don't think there's a driver on the grid that has been given so much time to find performance as Daniel Ricciardo. And I think, like, in many ways, that's kind of true. The narrative around Renault was kind of that, you know, maybe the car wasn't great, or maybe you had trouble getting used to the new car. And then the narrative of McLaren was very much like, okay, we're here, he's in, and like, he's gonna, you know, Lando better do good this year. And then Lando did good that year. And it was more kind of like, oh, didn't Lando do great? Not, was Daniel underperforming? And I think the longer this goes on, the trend lines are there, and it's very hard to dispute, you know, as much as, you know, I think we all like him. I think this is the reason why he's gotten so much rope in a way is because people really like Daniel. People on the grid like him. Fans like him. Neutrals like him. And he's also gone to teams that they've sort of wanted him to do well at. You know what I mean? There's no like bitterness coming from anyone else. There's no bitterness coming from Red Bull people. But he's going to these lower teams. There's no bad blood with any of this. He seems to even get on with Christian and Max still, and like, you know, Cyril getting tattoos for Zach. Everyone seems to like him. And I think that's the thing, is that we don't want him to fail. We like him as a presence in F1. We want him to do well. And he's got so much goodwill behind him that I think in a way that has sort of protected him. But it does feel like those protections have sort of eroded away in recent weeks, I would say.
Yeah, it's the funny thing is, it's just so much like the narrative, right? Of like being paired with Norris, who is able to like just get on with this car, and as a younger driver, it was always going to be tough, and it just like, I am not sure this is a. I'm not sure this is a salvageable situation. Like, even if, because he can't, if he just gets better in the McLaren and starts posting like decent number two numbers, you really need Daniel Ricciardo for that, when you could be casting about for, you know, who is going to be a longer term like stablemate for Norris. It's a tough situation that, again, I don't know where you would say the mistake was, right? Like, you could argue that it could have worked out better for everyone if he'd stayed at Red Bull. They might have notched a championship, at least, as a constructor by now, if it hadn't fallen out that way. But I definitely think that expectations were so different at Renault, and then he arrives at McLaren just as people start thinking this McLaren can really do some stuff. And also, he's paired with a really capable driver. It is just like, he really, he did set himself a very high bar to clear. And the worst thing possible has happened, which is he just has mysterious, I can't drive this car itis.
Yeah.
Which happens in F1. These cars are all really similar in terms of performance and drive completely different in terms of characteristic.
It's just such a bummer, right? Because I feel like we were talking about this last year, right? When there was a quote around this time when he was talking about, you know, it's sort of like the rub your belly, pat your hat pat your head thing, and then suddenly you have to rub your head and pat your belly. It's like sometimes the cars just work differently and you have to like remap your brain a bit. I think his age doesn't help in this situation as well, maybe, where like then you start to wonder about, he's not got, maybe if he's not a massive talent, he's 32 now, maybe he doesn't stretch his career into, you know, Alonso years. And what type of investment is he? You know, I bet he brings a lot of fans with him. I suspect a lot of the Drive to Survive fan base is also quite pro Daniel because he's sort of always had his little narrative in there.
Yeah, I'm sure Liberty would love him to stay in the sport.
Yeah, and he's not, and he's a great driver. Like we've seen him like do great drives in the past 2 years, like Monza last year, right? Like when it works, it works, and when I don't think anyone begrudges or doesn't like seeing that dude pour champagne into his dirty shoe. Like,
see it less. I'll be
maybe
regarding the shoey in particular. I could do with fewer shoeys. I think
when he got Patrick Stewart to drink it, that was one. Yeah. That was like top 10 F1 moments for me. That was pretty great.
I think the same way that Pierre Gasly's drive in AlphaTauri is great for his resume, I think this is doing the opposite thing for Ricardo's. Like, I think his prospects are dwindling. Like, what, even if you're, you know, Alfa Romeo, are you thinking like, oh, awesome, if Daniel's out, I'm going to snag him? Maybe if you're Alfa, I was thinking Aston Martin.
Right.
Maybe if you're Aston Martin, you do say that if Vettel retires or whatever. Or maybe they swap. A buddy of mine suggested that, and I can't get that out of my head.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting. It would be an interesting A-B test right there just to see how that feels. But yeah, I think you're, like, you're 100% right that the next trade feels different. The Renault one felt like, hey, he tried this. The parachute didn't work. This team didn't connect. Maybe hit them at the wrong time. Now that it's like happened again where he hasn't lit a team on fire and he is kind of, you know, his stock is dwindling basically.
Yeah.
And how much is left on it, I guess, is the ultimate question. But it is interesting when you pair him up against other drivers who are less charismatic, really, if you just put it down to that, like, you know, you don't have a lot of people clambering for Esteban Ocon, right? Super nice guy. He's like the most normal person on the grid. He's just like a normal dude. He's so nice, but he's just like, he's a normal guy. And you don't have that sort of affect with him. So, and Perez for the longest time, I would say as well, Perez was kind of just like a known quantity on the grid. You know, he's a bit of a Bottas maybe, like pretty, you know, shoulders were a little bit wide in some of those cars, always did a really good job, but like it wasn't like people were clamoring for Sergio Perez. Mm-hmm. But it's worked out that way, you know. This is his ultimate, like, it's amazing to think that after his long career and all the teams he's with, he will be remembered for what's going on right now, which is like, does not happen. Vettel, Alonso, you know, look at all these, like,
that's true.
Drivers.
The graph goes in a different direction.
Schumacher, totally. Of course it does. Barrichello, like, it does not tend to shake out that way, but Sergio is having that moment. I hope that happens to Daniel too, but yeah. It's a tough one. He's in a rough spot, all right. He really
needs
to switch it on
now. It'd be more of a U-shape, I think.
Yeah. Although, I think the problem is you run into the question of this does sort of raise question marks on his early career too, because the Red Bull was so dominant during that period that it raises doubt.
But he was closer to his teammates.
He was, but also Verstappen was earlier in his career too. I guess I'm just playing devil's advocate. I think given enough time, it might bring into question some of that stuff too, of like, was he as good as what we thought, or was it just a really, not just a really good car, but was a lot of it the car and the circumstances? It raises the questions, which I think also doesn't help him at all.
Well, speaking of weird shapes, let's take it to the track, Danny.
Baku in Europe, at least for a time in 2016. It was the European Grand Prix, back when we were still doing the European Grand Prix. Man, to do. We should do a whole preseason primer on the history of the European Grand Prix. What a weirdness. Yes, we went to Baku as part of the sort of mid-10s expansion. It is a Tilkadrome, which was, means it was designed by Herman Tilke, who is a designer of racetracks. Most of the sort of concrete actual circuits that we've added over the past couple of decades.
I heard you like Petro States, so I put a racetrack here.
The Baku Street Circuit, I'm going to throw it in there, might be his best track. Baku, when we went to it first in 2016, there were lots of questions. It looks like a go-kart track. There's lots of like 90-degree turns, which basically don't exist in F1. There's a couple of 90-degree turns into 90-degree turns, which are very, very strange. Which I was watching a circuit walk with Alexander Albon a few days ago, and he was like, some of the turns on this track, you do not exist in any F1 track except here. They're just like very weird. It's provided good races. It's incredibly technical and incredibly fast. The drivers like it. And it's also really tough. And it's provided a lot of like chaos over the years in terms of, like we were saying, manhole covers popping off, people crashing under safety car.
People crashing into castles.
Crashing into castles, crashing into straightaways and collecting themselves back on the track.
It is the most like a Mario Kart track, I think.
It's a very strange, yeah, because it has long straights and it has one of the most weirdly technical parts in F1. So it's a 51 lap race. It's very fast and technical. It's bumpy too because it's a street circuit. They have tended to do a little bit of resurfacing work on it every couple of years, but that sort of never really does all the work, especially to these ancient ass tracks. It is, I think, so Bottas broke the speed record here in 2016 for all of F1, which means it was faster than China. And that has an incredibly long straight.
Wow.
This technically in its third... Okay, actually, let me just break down the three sections. I've tried not to do this in recent years on this podcast because I know it's difficult for people to grok what I'm saying when I'm looking at a circuit map. But like, let me just... This is one of those... The three sectors are three different tracks. Sector one is a bunch of 90-degree turns. And the turning points and breaking points specifically for these are wicked hard. So turn one has a huge runoff area in front of it. Turn two has a runoff area in front of it. Turn three has a runoff area in front of it. And the reason why is that the breaking points on these are some of the hardest in the F1 track, especially turn three, because the amount of time you have to see if you've got the turn in right and you're not going to straight yourself into the other side of the track is so small. I was watching a Nico Rosberg video last week about this, that he was like, it is the toughest part of all of F1 to know whether or not you should go down the escape road or not. It's like almost impossible. So during qualifying laps is why this stuff is so tight. So the first section is really tough when it comes to braking zones. The second section is one of the most technical parts in all of F1. There's a couple of really weird little double right-hand nonsenses, and then it's this castle section which they all say is really hard. So it's unmissable. When you're watching the track, you'll see them drive past what looks like the sort of a turret on the, you know, the side of a castle wall, like a circular one. It's incredibly tight. You can't touch the inside curve, because if you do, you'll bottom out and you'll go straight into the wall. The wall like sort of deeks and moves like a bunch of different times. It's also uphill. And it's a right-hander, and the wall isn't curved. It's like a hexagon, so it's straight. So imagine you're driving along the edge of a hexagon. It's straight, and it has a point, and then you turn the corner more, and it's another straight and a point, and another straight and a point. You know what I mean? Like, instead of it being a curved turn where they can sort of spot the apex a little bit better, they're already an F1 car. They're going uphill, so they can't see anything. The only thing
often
they can see is
into the sun.
Into the sun, you're right. And they can't spot the apex because it keeps changing as they're turning the corner. It doesn't have a curve. A curve, your mind can figure out where the center of the curve is. If you're on a curve, you sort of can understand.
Well, and wiggling your steering wheel back and forth, which you have to do for this, like, you know, hard-edged thing, it can unsettle your car.
Yeah. So it's this whole part is Totally bamboozling. And then what's worse is that whole part, the trouble with Sector 2 is not over, because Turn 15 is one of the toughest braking zones in F1. It's another reason why there's a big runoff hidden to the right of it. It's because it's a super fast, you're taking loads of speed into it, it's downhill, so you just don't have a lot of the mechanical forces you do in other braking zones to basically snap that thing in. It's also why it's open on the left. You can kind of skip the curve if you want to. So all that, basically turn 16, it's a 20-turn race, but turn 16 is kind of the last turn onto a... It's basically flat out. There's a couple of turns on it, but they take it flat. And from all the stuff I was reading, that the drivers were like, this is where we breathe. This is like where we like collect ourselves and then get back into it. There was... in that Nico Rosberg video, he was talking about how that it was an older video I was watching from a couple of years back. He was talking about how that pit wall entrance used to be the scariest wall in all of F1 to him, because if anything happened to your car, you would go straight into it. And he was like, that would be the end of your career or life or whatever. And then we literally saw that happen to Max the last time we raced here, right? We didn't race here last year? I don't think. I'm trying to remember. But we had some pretty bad crashes there. We had... Stroll and Verstappen had incidents there. We've had crashes going into turn one, famously Ricciardo and Verstappen. We've had loads of
this
stuff.
This is
here.
Where so, Hamilton, messed up his braking on the restart. This is where Verstappen's tire just exploded. Like, it seems that even independent of the track, weird stuff happens in Baku. So it's one that
magic.
If you're going to watch one, you should watch Baku.
Yeah, it tends to provide fun races, and at the very least, you'll get some safety car restarts.
Yeah, because again, there's no margin for error. It's just a Death Star trench run.
Yeah.
A lot of walls. I did look up the Bottas speed record, 378 kilometers per hour or 234.8.
Wild.
Miles an hour.
Yeah, madness.
In a street circuit.
In a street circuit, you're right. In a street circuit, yeah. But it's also safe. Like, there's no... Except for that one weird corner on the straightaway, it's not a track where, it's a track where there's a lot of crashes in fourth gear into the outside apex, outside of an apex, that type of thing.
Safe is relative, but it doesn't freak me out like Saudi Arabia,
No, 100%. It's not that. I would even say Monaco has parts that are... like exiting the tunnel where it's you don't want to crash. There are places where you don't want to crash in those tracks, and I feel like here there's so much runoff or so many escape roads that they kind of know where it'll happen at speed. Famous last words, but touching wood.
Well, thankfully for the drivers, I guess zero precipitation looks to be the case for qualifying and race day. Temperatures though, around 78 degrees Fahrenheit or 26 Celsius for qualifying day. And then on race day, it's a little earlier in the day, so 84 degrees Fahrenheit or 29 Celsius. And the wind picks up on race day. So from, let's see, 10 miles an hour to 15 miles an hour or 16 to 24 kilometers an hour. So be on the lookout for that. It's on the edge of the Caspian Sea, is that right?
Yeah. And also I didn't mention it, but this is a good track regardless of the new cars. So it's going to be fun to see if they can follow each other. Like, it's already a really long straight with a DRS at the end. There's a DRS at the end of it. Like, you've already done the straight and then the straight's still going and then the DRS opens. So,
that's right, yeah.
Like, I think with these cars able to, I think there was a famous incident here where Ricciardo overtook three people on that straight in one go.
That's right. Yeah,
So I think there is no better candidate maybe for let's see how much fun you can have in these new cars than Baku.
Well, let's run down the driver standings ahead of this weekend's race. Max Verstappen is on top with 125 points to Charles Leclerc's 116, and Sergio Perez in third with 110. George Russell is in fourth with 84 points, right ahead of Carlos Sainz with 83. In sixth place, Lewis Hamilton with 50 points, followed by Lando Norris in seventh with 48, Valtteri Bottas in eighth with 40, Esteban Ocon has 30. Kevin Magnussen holding down 10th position with 15 points. Then we've got a tie for 11th place between Daniel Ricciardo and Yuki Tsunoda. Fernando Alonso just 1 point behind in 13th place with 10. Pierre Gasly's in 14th with 6. Then we've got Sebastian Vettel with 5. Alex Albon with 3. Lance Stroll with 2. Zhou Guanyu with 1 in 18th place. And then Mick Schumacher, Nicholas Latifi, and Nico Hülkenberg with 0.
Zero.
I saw Sebastian Vettel saying to everyone, hey, chill out on Mick Schumacher. Just give him a second. Give him time. I can feel him coming. It's going to happen this year.
If we're talking about like drivers with goodwill behind them, Mick Schumacher can have an entire career of not scoring points and he will remain in F1. Like, I'm not saying that will happen. I'm not casting aspersions on Mick. He has a very good career in previous Formula One and formulas. But such is the importance of his family's legacy and what they've given to the sport that I don't think there's going to be very little pressure coming from Mick Schumacher for quite a while.
In constructor standings, Red Bull is on top with 235 points to Ferrari's 199. Ooh. Mercedes is in third with 134, then a jump down to McLaren in fourth with 59. Alfa Romeo in fifth with 41, above Alpine with 40. Then we've got Alfa Tauri with 17, which I would have thought they'd be higher. Or with more points, at least. Gene Haas and team have 15 points. Aston Martin with 7, and Williams with 3. Should we take it to the emails, Danny?
Let's do it. shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.co/emails. This one comes in from Andrew. Been a fan of the show for a while, but there was some confusion about the pit exit line drama in the show this week that I thought I should clarify. When Verstappen touched the pit exit line during the race, stewards mistook him for Perez. And so the on-screen graphic and presumably the race information the teams get said they were investigating Perez. After the race, presumably, to be thorough, Ferrari named both Red Bull drivers in their protest. You covered Verstappen ruling well, but the stewards found and Ferrari agreed that Perez never touched the line at all. Thanks for the pod. This is true. I noticed this afterwards too as well. Perez's on-screen camera. I think Julian Palmer had one of his breakdown videos on YouTube, and you can watch the full ones on F1 TV. He broke it down. I saw the Perez on board and I was like, oh, he's nowhere near the line. So I don't know what happened. And then I saw the Verstappen one, and the Verstappen one's marginal. It's not as slam dunk as I thought it was around the time.
If the rule is touching the line, is over the line, then it's not marginal. But that apparently was not the rule there or whatever. Right.
Rob, can you do this one from Alan?
Yeah, Alan writes, after the start of the season, we all thought Ferrari was going to run away with both titles. But after Monaco, the question has to be if Ferrari are snakebitten or if they're their own worst enemy. A random breakdown like in Spain happens, but with Red Bull looking confident and even winning in places where they haven't looked dominant, do you think Ferrari just lacks the knowledge and confidence to carry a lead forward, or is it just down to bad circumstances? It's been decades now not meeting expectations, even with strong packages with Alonso and then Vettel on the team. They still haven't been able to put it all together since the 2000s. So first, we never thought Ferrari was going to run away with both titles. Like, Red Bull was like cruising to a win at the start of the season, and both their cars broke down. Like, in terms of who has the most pace, it's been pretty neck and neck. It was always going to be a fight that goes the distance. And Red Bull's been in a lot more of those in recent years. The other thing is, increasingly, I regard that Vettel season where he was in the hunt for the championship as kind of a mirage, in part because we now know that some of the performance they gained literally came from a rules loophole they were exploiting to get extra straight line power. I think there's a few factors. I think we already sort of alluded to the fact that you have to have been here before in order to like really handle these kind of pressure crunch time situations. And that's true of both the drivers and the pit wall. And there is a bit of luck. But I do think that Ferrari are having their inexperience at managing a championship fight be exposed. And they're up against a team that is very experienced at this and a driver who, I think especially after last year, just does not react to pressure the way he used to. And Leclerc and Sainz have not had that moment. And so I think there's a lot of things at Ferrari that they've built a really good car. Running that car to a championship is a really different set of skills.
It's the like A/B test between the two sets of drivers is remarkable because you have Perez who's in this great run of form. You have Verstappen who has gotten the monkey off his back. He won his championship. Fine. Like he's done it. And then you have Leclerc who cannot seem to win Monaco. Everything happens wrong for him to do that. And then Carlos Sainz, who just keeps spinning it in, like, you know, ways that are often not his fault, but sometimes are his fault. And then it's totally rattled him as well. Last year, the title deciding race at the end of the season came down to a moment of luck, but it was because both teams fought for every point before that. That meant that when the luck swung one way, it ended up deciding the title. It's clearly an era in F1, or at least last year was, and it seems like this year is, where you just can't make bad, small, silly mistakes. You won't win a championship if you do it. And at least when you look at the first selection of races from this year, Ferrari have made a lot of mistakes. And Red Bull have had bad things happen to their cars. And I think if you shake that out over the course of the year, Ferrari are going to have a tough time trying to win this one. But, you know, as we always see, give it a couple more races and the pendulum swings.
It's true.
Drew, do you want to take this one from Allison?
Yes, Allison writes, "Hi there. My boyfriend and I have 3-day grandstand passes for the Montreal Grand Prix, our first one. Very exciting.
Awesome.
I recently got an email about attending the pit lane walk on Thursday morning. From what I've gathered, anyone can attend, no reservations needed. There's only a 3-hour window for this. Can anyone tell me what exactly this is and if it's worth going? I'm surprised it's such a short time frame with anyone allowed to attend, so it's not as interesting as it sounds. So is it not as interesting as it sounds? Any other advice for making sure we make the most of our Grand Prix weekend? Thank you." All right, first of all, the pit lane walk. We did not do in Austin, Danny. So I don't exactly know, but from some photos I looked up, it looks like kind of what you would expect. They opened the pit lane, and I think the garages are open.
Yeah.
And they've just got some, you know, some velvet ropes between you and the cars.
So I don't want to give wrong expectations, but I do know people who have done this, and like, I would go. To me, it sounded cool because it's a bit like, don't go expecting this will happen. But sometimes the vibe is a bit like, I don't know if Danny, I certainly don't know if they did this like over in Ireland or the UK, but like in the States growing up, there were days where it was like they would open up the firehouse to let people like sort of just like walk by. And like sometimes you talk to the firemen and it was like, wow, firemen. And there's a bit of that with like the open, like the pit lane walk. Not always. Like people are busy. Some of the teams are more obliging with people wanting to take pictures or like wanting to ask questions to mechanics than others. Like for instance, I wouldn't go try to chat up anyone at Mercedes. on the other hand, I do know people who did not work at Red Bull who chatted up like Red Bull mechanics, and like the mechanics were like, "Oh yeah, like come on, I want to show you. Yeah, you're cool. Like, come look at this thing. It's really neat. You'll get a kick out of this." So like, it's like at the very least, you'll have sort of a neat, like almost a public fair parade day where you get to just like be proximate to a place you don't normally get to.
Yeah.
And at best, sometimes you meet a cool person who will be like, and not in a creepy way, not like because they're trying to hit on you or your partner, who will be like, "Oh no, I can show you a really cool thing," or "I'm happy to sit here and explain parts of my job."
Yeah. Yeah, I would say going, first of all, just sitting in the grandstands and seeing the cars for the first time it's kind of like in itself seeing a celebrity. You're like, this is the things I've seen on TV. And so seeing them up close is pretty cool. And I think it would give you a really good, I don't know, just like feeling for what the physical space of the pit lane is like. And so it just give a different dimension to seeing it on TV and like being able to see into the garage and just get that, you know, on the ground vantage point. And just being on the racetrack is cool. You know, like what, going from the grandstands to when after the race, they open up the track and everyone can walk onto it. It feels like you're in a different place. Like it's just, it's cool. So I would definitely do this. I imagine the 3-hour window is just like, you know, so they can, you know, manage the crowds. But I don't imagine it would take that long. It'd probably just like, you know, take half hour or so.
Yeah. I think, yeah, if you're excited with the baseline of I'll just see some cars, then it's like a win-win, right? Just go and enjoy it. And if something else happens, that's cool. Like, I think that's the mentality I take with it is, yeah, I just want to see some cool cars. Because, yeah, seeing them up front is totally different. Yeah.
It might also give you a good chance to, you know, figure out how to get to the circuit, how to make your way around the circuit, you know, find your seats, that sort of thing. That's generally what I recommend on practice day. Or, you know, free practice 3, getting there early. So you're not scrambling to make qualifying and figure everything out. So, you know, if you did this on Thursday, maybe you didn't have to go to see practice. Maybe you could go, you know, wander around Montreal, eat some, poutine. Yeah.
Is that poutine? Poutine, I think it's a different thing. I think that's a different. Yep. All right. Anyway, sorry, everyone. Okay. I'll take this last email from Kevin. Hi, Shift F1 team. Today I attended a talk with the CEO of CrowdStrike, one of the major sponsors of Mercedes. He told a story about how Toto Wolff directs every employee at Mercedes F1 team to find their equivalent at Red Bull or Ferrari and place a picture of that person on their desk. The idea being that everyone from the secretary to the drivers to the janitors should look at that person every day and remember that the goal is to beat that person on the other teams. My question is, what other unique or interesting things have principals or drivers used to motivate their teams? Thank you for the great content every week. If this is true, this is psychopathic.
I believe it. I
100% believe it. This.
He's got a picture of Christian Horner on his desk.
And he just it's like Lou Ferrigno in Pumping Iron, where he's just like lifting weights to a picture of Arnold, just going, Arnold, Arnold.
I wanted to propose a different question to what Kevin said, which is that who would we put on our is it like, is there, Will I Buxton. Don't know enough of the like WTF1 did people,
you,
but like,
did you
maybe,
say Will Buxton,
yes,
Rob?
Will Buxton.
I would put, and this is half antagonism, half like, oh, I like this guy. It's Lee Diffie. The Australian commentator, yeah, who used to do NBC sports calls.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. I might go for in a similar vein of, I don't actually not like this person, but like I would aspire to be as good as them. Mm-hmm. Like Jimmy Broadbent. Like, so, you know what,
okay,
I mean? Like,
yeah,
like, you know, good commentator,
I
good video
just
game player.
To Eddie Jordan. And I was going to be like, yeah, all right. Well, I mean, set your sights high.
I do not have nearly a nice selection of colorful shirts. I don't think I could pull that off. I wear probably black shirts almost every day. So
Eddie
I'm kind
Jordan
of like
is one of those characters, and I'm like, he is the most like James Hunt and Eddie Jordan, I think, are the two people that I'm like, F1 has really changed. Like, you don't understand,
yes,
what it used,
yes,
to be like and who used to be like hanging around the grid.
Totally, yeah. God, he doesn't even do punditry anymore, I don't think.
No,
I
feel like I've seen him occasionally pop up on the Sky broadcast, but definitely like in a irregular guest role. But yeah, it's what a goofy. I always sort of wonder about that stuff because it's like it's the technique is enemy building, and
right,
I've always kind of. Like, whatever works for you, fine. I've always been really wary about instituting that throughout a culture. And I think the reason, like,
right,
not everyone is going to be wired the way Toto Wolff is. And I think when you're trying to institute that, where it's like, this is a method that's been really powerful for me,
Yes.
Like, you're turning your thing into an exercise in, like, corporate narcissism. And I don't dig that stuff. It's like where Ron Dennis, when he built the McLaren Technology Center, and when he was at the sort of the zenith of his power within McLaren, you know, wanted everyone to have these, like, beautiful, sparse, minimalist, precision-engineered workspaces. And he, like, passed things down where it's like, you know, you're forbidden from having, like, personal photos and personal effects on your desk. And it's like, well, okay, now we're just being, like, you're not, like, now we're just being crazy. Because, like, there are some people who find clutter creative. Like, sorry, Ron, I know it's not your Steve Jobsian, like, icy minimalist paradise, but, like, these are huge collaborative environments, and a big part of that thing is leaving space for, like, certainly offer people techniques, but I think the minute you're like, and we all should do this, I mean, the answer is almost certainly, no, you shouldn't. You should figure out, like, there should be space for people to figure out what works for them.
Totally. Like, the idea, I 100% agree. And I feel like in 2022, especially, people should, like, know that, like, you can't mandate the way people think or react or encourage themselves or motivate themselves. It's such a personal thing. It's so all over the place. Like, yeah, the idea, like, in many ways, like, I can see a lot of that in the way that I have worked over the years. And, like, I do a lot of, like, looking at other people and trying to, like, see how best I can, like, ape that or be inspired by that or have an antagonistic relationship as well. But it's like, I don't suspect that most people have my sickness. so it's weird that, like, he would mandate that. If that's the case, who knows? This CrowdStrike guy might also just be, like, fucking telling tall tales or whatever, just so he can do his talk.
I feel I've heard Wolf do this, though, before. Yeah. Like, I do wonder if it is, like, I think if somebody's like, you know what? I'm putting my picture of Adrian Newey away. I don't, like, I would hope Toto's gonna be like, to his, like, lead aerodynamicist, hey, where's Adrian? Why aren't you thinking about what he's doing right now? Because I would be like, sorry, man, I'm thinking about aerodynamics, not Adrian.
Thanks, everyone, for the emails at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.col/emails.
Yes, that is it for emails. You can also hit us up at shiftf1podcast@shiftf1podcast. At twitter.com. I am at Drew Scanlon. That is at Danny O'Dwyer and at Rob Zachney. That's us around the internet. Should we take it around the world, Danny?
Let's race around the world. Hey, who?
Well, the Isle of Man TT concludes Friday, and boy, oh boy.
Yeah.
Three people killed this year?
Oh, my.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thoughts with everyone affected, geez Louise. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it a lot over the years. There's no point in getting into it again. But it's rough. That's rough, man.
Yeah. The 24 Hours of Le Mans is also this weekend, featuring one, the only, Michel Fassbender.
Oh my God.
That's right. He is on the official 2022 Le Mans 24 Hours entry list.
Oh my God, I can't wait for this year's season of Road to Le Mans.
Yes.
Wow.
Bins it in the first stint before sundown.
Come on.
Two
I
episodes
see that.
Of watching him just, like, pace in the trailer.
I've never been. I want that Irishman to get that flag up on the podium, man. Make it happen.
The World Superbike Championship is at Misano this weekend. World Circuit, Marcos Cimoncelli. Yes. Formula 2 is supporting Formula 1 in Baku this weekend. We've also got the Camping World Truck there in our backyard at Sonoma Raceway.
Yeehaw!
For the DoorDash 250.
It's a very Bay Area sponsorship.
It really is. IndyCar is at Road America this weekend. Nice. We've got the Motocross Grand Prix at, Talkessel in Germany.
Talkessel.
And we got NASCAR.
Oh my.
They're also in the great state of California. For the Toyota Save Mart 350.
Save Mart. Don't know many Save Marts.
Nope. I know some Toyotas, though.
And Formula 2. I'm sorry, Formula 1.
Nothing more American than a Toyota.
That's certainly true. Friday, Formula 1 kicks off June 10th. Free practice 1, 7 a.m. Eastern time. On ESPN2, followed by free practice 2 at 10 a.m. Eastern time. ESPN2 also. Saturday, June 11th, free practice 3 is at 7 a.m. on ESPNU, followed by qualifying at 10 a.m. on ESPN2. And the race, everyone, Sunday, June 12th, 7 a.m. Eastern time on ESPN.
Looking forward
Final
to
Final thoughts?
Baku's good time. Hey, look, man. We can wait another 12 months to complain about Monaco. It's in the rearview mirror. We complain for that 1 week. That's it. Hey, we should get rid of Monaco. Don't get rid of Monaco. It's part of what would the Triple Crown be? Don't worry about it. We got a better street circuit coming up. Baku.
Yeah, we got cool like, Monaco.
We got cool Monaco. No casinos, no rich people. Well, there's probably a lot of rich people there. It's a
petro state.
It's a petro state. So I'll take it back. Different type of rich person. But hey, they race here. Also, history and fast parts and overtaking. Overtaking. Imagine Monaco and overtaking.
Final thoughts, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, this has become one of my favorite tracks, and it is such a unique place. Every single lap feels like a high wire act. And it does seem to generate a lot of memorable races, just from the strain it puts on the cars and the drivers. So I'm always excited for this one. And now that we've cursed it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep. We've done the reverse curse. Now it's time for the forward curse. All right. Well, that is it for us this week. If you would like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes and the official Shift F1 Discord, you could do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.